Just quickly, by way of our sponsors, just as you know, it takes money to do these programs. We have a wonderful cost for how much, you know, we have to pay as members of a society, about a third of what most of these conferences would cost. But we owe a great debt to our sponsors. And so we have our title sponsors that contribute large sums of money that help make the cost of this program more reasonable. And so we do have a lot of these title sponsors, a couple of new ones with Davis Hospital and Tanner Clinic, as well as the National Kidney Foundation is an annual, you know, great partner, UMA, Weber State. And then as I look at this small list there, I also think about my time during college. I was fortunate to have a full ride scholarship down at what my med school calls the school down south. But my boss during the summers had a horse ranch and a multimillionaire from Kemmerer, Wyoming. And I'd get a $100 bonus usually at Christmas time. And I thought about, to her, that was a wonderful amount of money. To her, that was probably not much, you know, but a drop in the bucket. And I also want to recognize the fact we have a lot of individuals who contribute, you know, smaller amounts, but to them it's a great sacrifice to help each of us have this great conference. And so as these placards flash up, we do want to thank our large sponsors as well as the small individual sponsors who contribute greatly from their widow's mite type contribution. And so if we give a round of applause for all those that help sponsor this, it'd be great. I'd like to give Dr. Campbell just a minute to note the poster winners, and we'll have our first speaker.
So it's always a delight to address you. I noticed there were no vegetables yet at breakfast. So a number of years ago, Dr. Sharman was the president of this society, and during his reign, we had an interesting breakfast menu. We had granola and other forms of tree bark, and there were no bacon, there was no eggs, and we have never had the incredible avalanche of feedback that we had on those meals. It was not so positive. So the idea of vegetables and tree bark is good, but at this point we are still serving bacon and eggs. So one more opportunity to use the bully pulpit here. I want to mention briefly something that we are sponsoring at McCady Hospital. For all of you who live in Weber and Morgan and Davis counties, we have a medical explorer post at the hospital. On the first and third Thursdays of the month, from September through early May, we have the juniors and seniors from the local high schools gather, and we teach them about what it would be like to be in medicine. It's not restricted to be physicians, but rather any part of the medical field, including therapists, trainers, doctors, nurses, dentists, and so on. It's a great opportunity for the young people. If they find that there is something of interest to them, it's a great way to get started and head them off onto more education. And likewise, if they discover this is not for me, it's also a great use of their time. So if you have friends, neighbors, patients, or family that are interested in joining the Medical Explorer post, please let me know, or even though she doesn't know this yet, you can let Teresa know and give her your contact information, and we'll get back to you on that. I have the opportunity to present the winners of the poster contest yesterday. We hope that this grows every year, and so if you have any interest or involvement with anybody that would be interested in presenting a poster, which can include you as well, by the way, great opportunity to present interesting cases, then let us know. We'd like to grow this so that that room is absolutely packed with posters. So there were two parts this year, the student posters and the resident posters. So the winner for the student posters was the presenters Devin Johnson, Dean Bowman, and Spencer Jude describing competencies for the CRISPR genes. Did anybody look at that? I mean, pretty quick, at least I noticed for me that pretty quick I was nodding very, trying to look intelligent because it was... pretty impressive science. So number one was for the CRISPR genes. Expression of SLC6A3 in persistent ADHD, Ryan Anderson, David Merkley, and Lucas Wadups was number two. And then number three, the effects of various stilbenoids on motility growth, biofilm formation, and quorum sensing of E. coli 157H7. An interesting way to maybe attack disease-causing bacteria without antibiotics. That was Maria Svager, Angie Cefalo, and Dimitri Stasinos. So then for our resident posters, number one, Mike Matthews, Jansen Slater, improving care transitions with minimal effort. Number two, emergency department usage among high ED users within Porter Clinic, Caleb Swanberg and Joey Hansen. And number three, quality improvement intervention to increase the percentage of diabetic patients with A1Cs less than 9, Carl Chen. So those were, all of the resident posters were from McKD and from U of U. Again, we hope to grow that so that we have more opportunities. A great resume item for those that participate. So a round of applause for all of our winners, please. So at this point, it's my privilege to introduce our speaker. Now, I asked Erin if she wanted me to say anything about her. She said she'd introduce herself. So in a way, that gives me the free microphone to just say anything I want about her. But rather than mess up the stage, I'll turn the time over to Dr. Clark. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much and good morning. This is my first visit to this meeting and I'm honored to be here to talk to you today about something that I happen to be very passionate about, which is personalized prenatal care. This idea of sort of not a one size fits all approach for every pregnant woman. And that goes hand in hand with evidence-based care. I currently serve as Division Director for Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of Utah. I took over about a year ago from Bob Silver, who some of you may know. He now serves as our interim chairman of the Department of OBGYN. And we're going to start today's talk slowly. Got it. Okay. We're going to start in the early 20th century. Do you guys recognize these people? So this is Downton Abbey. This is a British period drama that aired on PBS. It took place in the early 20th century in an English manor house. The lord of the manor house had a daughter named Sybil, who you see on the left. She married the chauffeur and they had a baby. See, this was a drama, right? And in this show, it has a very dramatic depiction of death from eclampsia after Sybil delivers. I usually show this clip, but for the interest of time, we're going to skip it today, but it's worthy watching if you haven't seen it before. You can see it on YouTube just by Googling Downton Abbey and Sybil's death. It's a heart-wrenching thing to watch, particularly for an obstetrician, given that today most deaths from eclampsia can be largely averted using the prescribed system of prenatal care visits, which have since been developed. This idea that seeing a woman once a month through the first two trimesters of pregnancy, and then every 2 weeks, and every week in the last month of pregnancy, was largely introduced in order to recognize pre-eclampsia with a combination of blood pressures and monitoring for urine protein so that you could avert eclampsia and deaths like Sybil's. And in the decades that followed the initiation of that sort of prescribed system of visits, maternal mortality fell by 100-fold. I mean, 100-fold. That's one of the greatest medical success stories that ever was. And it was due to a reduction in hemorrhage and a reduction in infection, as well as a reduction in eclampsia. But it was a remarkable change over the course of a century. And interestingly, that system of prenatal care, which was introduced, while we now do a little bit different surveillance in terms of imaging and labs, that basic prescribed system of visits has been largely unaltered for a century. So the question is, how do we move forward from there towards more current evidence-based prenatal care. Prenatal care in the United States, with nearly 4 million births now annually, is one of the most widely used preventative health strategies. But despite its ubiquitous practice, the optimal quantity and character of prenatal care remains controversial. We have a paucity of randomized controlled trials that address content, and there's questions about efficacy. What components do you really need? What's really working? What are the things that are really reducing mortality? And efficiency, how much of it do you actually need? There's lots of questions about those two issues that remain. As early as 1989, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services said that the specific content and timing of visits, contacts, and education should vary depending on the risk status of the pregnant woman and her fetus. While we nod to this, still, the vast majority of pregnant women, whether they have diabetes or they're totally uncomplicated, really have about the same number of visits. So it's been a few decades since this recommendation came out, but it has not been widely implemented. We still have a very much a one-size-fits-all approach. They proposed at that time that there be a reduced frequency prenatal care schedule for low-risk women who had had babies before. For proven reproducers, the risk is very low. And that those visits should really be based on the timing of specific events and testing. You know, if you need to be seen for a physical exam, a laboratory assessment, for imaging, those should be the visits that are scheduled. And they recommended reducing the number of visits from about 14, which is what you come up with that once a month through the first two trimesters, every 2 weeks after that, and then every week in the final month, down to 8. World Health Organization actually says we should do 4. Now, that's a very low-resource setting, and they're saying that in 4 visits, you can accomplish most of what constitutes evidence-based prenatal care. So what should we be doing? There's lots of guidelines out there. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, American Academy of Pediatrics, Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, and even the Department of Defense has weighed in on this topic. And they all recommend a system of goal-oriented antenatal visits at specific gestational ages and endorse a reduced schedule of prenatal visits compared to traditional models for low-risk women. And yet, despite all of these recommendations, when we survey obstetric practices, no matter who the care providers are, midwifery, family practice, or OBGYN, in general, these recommendations have not been implemented. And in general, we sort of have stuck to that historic model. So a lot of questions come up about, when I propose this, stepping ahead, doing something different, a lot of questions come up about safety. Is it safe to have less visits? This issue has been completely put to rest by a number of large randomized controlled trials. In a systematic review of 7 of those trials, we have shown that a reduced prenatal care model, somewhere between 4 to 9 visits, versus standard of care, which is 13 to 15 visits, is a safe strategy. These trials enrolled 57,000 low-risk women in a spectrum of resource settings and showed no difference in maternal or perinatal morbidity or mortality. There was a trend towards some increased decreased satisfaction among there was a trend towards increased dissatisfaction with care among women receiving that care, especially those who are receiving care in developed countries. But despite compelling safety and efficacy data, prenatal care practices in the U.S. have generally continued this one-size-fits-all approach. And the question is why? With all of the data that we have suggesting a reduced care model is safe, with the recommendations from all the organizations that we discussed, what has limited us? What we think is really that there have been concerns centered around this observation of decreased satisfaction from patients. There's been a reluctance among providers to do something new and different. And I think we have to ask ourselves, what else? What else is preventing us from adopting evidence-based medicine? And I could probably sum it up in one word. And I think that word is dogma. I think, you know, there's dogma in all of our fields, but the way we do prenatal care is sort of deeply entrenched in the world of OBGYN. when we try and stray from that dogma, it gives people chest pain. Dogma, by its definition, really cannot be changed or discarded without affecting the very system's paradigm. And it's paradigm shift that would need to happen if we were going to implement change in this area. So the question that we ask ourselves and are continuing to ask ourselves is, then what is required? What baby step can we take to move the needle towards evidence-based medicine while not alienating our patient base and not alienating our care providers? And to me, I look at this dilemma as sort of a managing the population question. So if you think about managing a population of pregnant women, you can very simplistically divide them into two different buckets. Now there's lots of gray in between, but you can conceptualize a high-risk bucket of women and a low-risk bucket of women. In the higher risk group, you've got women who have chronic diseases like chronic hypertension and diabetes. You have women with prior pregnancy complications like eclampsia. You have women with current pregnancy complications like placenta previa, and you have fetal abnormalities or multiple gestations. And everybody else would fit theoretically into that other bucket. Healthy women, prior uncomplicated pregnancies, current uncomplicated pregnancies, and a single normal fetus. And if we look at that group more closely, sort of our model today, we're going to start by looking at what would we do with this low-risk group. This would be a group of women in sort of their middle reproductive years who've had a previous term delivery, no serious pregnancy complications, no chronic medical conditions, no major risk factors for an adverse outcome. And we tried to conceive of what the baby step would be forward, and came up with the novel idea to do a clinical trial where we're comparing a novel remote monitoring strategy and a reduced number of in-clinic visits with traditional prenatal care. Is the baby step to keep the number of prenatal care visits the same, in other words, but only do a fraction of them face-to-face, and the rest do by sort of a telemedicine strategy, thereby keeping the same number of contacts with a provider and hopefully retaining satisfaction, but also making for a more efficient, cost-effective method of providing prenatal care and much more evidence-based according to current guidelines. And patient satisfaction would have to be the primary outcome, because that is the dilemma that we have. We know it's safe. Can we keep people satisfied? The hope is they'd be at least as satisfied with the prenatal care that we have now, that they'd have no difference in obstetric outcomes, which I would argue has already been demonstrated, and that we could provide this care at a lower cost to the healthcare system and at lower cost to the patient. And so we embarked on a randomized controlled trial. This completed enrollment about a year ago at the University of Utah. It enrolled low-risk pregnant women, mostly in the first trimester of pregnancy, and randomized them into two types of care. 5 scheduled prenatal care visits at time points that make sense. Your first visit, the visit where you get your routine 18 to 20-week ultrasound, the visit at 28 weeks where you're doing things like diabetes screening, 35 weeks for your group B strep swab, and a delivery planning visit. And that has all the sort of components of evidence-based face-to-face care covered. And then the remaining visits would be by telemedicine. And that was compared to our standard model for prenatal care. We put about 100 women in each arm, and our primary outcome was overall patient satisfaction with prenatal care as assessed after delivery. And just to talk about a little bit about what that strategy might look like, remember that we know that less visits is safe. There's no need to monitor women at home to have a safe model of prenatal care. However, in order for patients to adopt this and feel comfortable, for physicians to adopt this and feel comfortable, and for patients to feel empowered about their own care, we felt that it was important that they track their pregnancies some at home. And if you look at this strategy, we said, well, we can give women a blood pressure cuff. Most of them have a scale or can be given one, and they can learn how to use a fetal Doppler monitor. Many women are using a Doppler monitor at home now. They often just don't tell us that they are, and the fact is that they do very well at it. So we can set people up to get these measurements within their home environment, and then we can give them access to a patient portal whereby they can input that information for us to see. We happen to use Epic, so we use MyChart as our patient portal. And then we conceived of a HIPAA-compliant web-based strategy whereby a physician and a patient can see each other to do their prenatal care. We gave people a schedule of prenatal care visits that you see on the left where it reminded people, am I going face-to-face or am we doing this at home? So people didn't get confused. And on the right is just a picture of an example of a prenatal care visit that I did with one of my patients. So she's sitting in her own kitchen on her laptop, and we're talking about her prenatal care and her pregnancy. The vast majority of what's covered during prenatal care visits is education and answering questions. And that can easily be done using this mechanism. We had people do their prenatal care visits from their office. We had a visit on a plane. We had people do it from foreign countries. We had people do it at home with little kids jumping on the couch behind them, right? It sort of empowered them to do prenatal care at the time and place that they wanted. And the first step when we were sort of looking at our outcomes were, did we actually reduce the number of visits? Because if we didn't reduce the number of visits, then this was a moot point. This was the first step towards saying, was this new model successful? Now, we enrolled people sometimes after they had had a visit or two up front in clinic, and we did not mandate that they could only have 5 visits. We said, you should schedule 5. You can see people above and beyond that as much as you want. If complications came up, they were kept in that arm. So all of those visits, if they develop preeclampsia or whatever, are included in these numbers. So we succeeded insofar as the total number of visits in the traditional arm and the remote arm were the same. Everyone had about 12. But in the remote arm, only 7 of those were face-to-face. So we reduced the number of on-site visits pretty substantially. And this was our primary outcome. So we're still in data analysis phase for this trial, but it'll hopefully be published within the next few months. This was the primary outcome. Gray is traditional prenatal care, red is our remote model of prenatal care, and the number of women who were satisfied or very satisfied was extremely high in both arms. Prenatal care at our institution started very high and it wasn't compromised by adopting a new model. Now, Mayo Clinic did something very similar to this type of study called OB-NEST, only their traditional prenatal care, they see a different provider every time. They don't have an assigned provider. So when they implemented this type of prenatal care, they added continuity to their care because they saw the same provider by telemedicine every time. So their satisfaction went from pretty dismal, actually, to very high. We retained high level of satisfaction with this study. When we asked women, are you satisfied with remote prenatal care for monitoring your health during pregnancy? There were a whole bunch of questions like this. The vast majority of people agreed or strongly agreed. When we asked them, what are the 3 most important reasons that you liked receiving remote prenatal care? I don't know that the answer surprised me, but time savings, less people driving back and forth, having to park, wait in a doctor's office, the convenience of those type of visits, and then cost savings ranked very highly. When we asked women what their preference was for in-person versus remote visits based on the epoch of pregnancy, so less than 20 weeks on the left, 20 to 36 weeks in the middle, and then the last month of pregnancy on the right, most people liked the mix. They wanted to be seen face-to-face for some of their visits. They liked remote care for the remainder. You'll notice that the gray bar, only in-person visits, did increase after 36 weeks, so about a third of women said, I would have rather switched over to all face-to-face visits in the last month, which is an interesting observation. And almost everybody said, when we asked them, how was your overall experience with this trial? They said that learning to operate the remote equipment was easy, that they were comfortable doing it, and that it was easy to do. In the end, the satisfaction with this trial was very high, but we had to overcome a lot of hurdles, and primarily those hurdles were the reluctance of physicians to adopt a new model. Even taking this baby step forward to move the needle towards evidence-based care required a tremendous amount of time and effort, just to get people willing to do something a little bit different. We built this into our clinic such that it had minimal impact on a provider. It was modeled such that they walked into a clinic room and instead of seeing a patient there, there was a computer there. And the patient was on the computer. And so they really didn't have to do anything different. If you were going to implement this in the most cost-effective way, you would probably take those visits out of the clinic space and put it in a designated telemedicine space so that you could increase capacity for your clinics. This is the way in which it would be cost-effective for a healthcare system to implement. We are embarking on cost-effectiveness studies now. There's no question that there's cost savings for patients who miss less work, have to pay for less childcare, and spend less gas going back and forth from visits. The modeling for the healthcare system is a little bit more complicated. But again, I think the gold in this system, as far as it goes for payers and healthcare systems, is that it can improve the efficiency of care and increase capacity. You can see more patients for less money and have more people face-to-face in your clinics by putting these in a telemedicine space. In the end, I think that personalized prenatal care means giving people a choice. The University of Utah, well, we have been enamored of this idea of offering people remote prenatal care as part of their strategy. It will never be a mandate. Participation in this trial was voluntary. We are not going to see as high a satisfaction rates if we require people to do this type of prenatal care. We have to give them a choice. And I can foresee a menu of prenatal care, much like you see here, where you say, you can choose from the following evidence-based options. Do you want to do just a handful of visits? It's safe. You can add to those visits by doing some of them by telemedicine. You can do traditional prenatal care. Or you can do, some of you are familiar with this concept of centering group care, where you go through your prenatal visits as a group of women. To some women, these things sound amazing. You give the same woman, a different woman, the same set of choices, and they choose something completely different. So patient choice is at the heart of patient satisfaction. We don't have time to talk about the high-risk bucket today, but I think you could foresee how this kind of prenatal care, this novel strategy, could be extrapolated to a high-risk group, right? There's nothing magic about taking care of a diabetic or a chronic hypertensive compared to a low-risk patient, as long as you have the appropriate surveillance that you need, and a lot of that can be done remotely. So you could certainly conceive of a strategy whereby you're taking care of a group of diabetic women and monitoring their sugars from afar and doing their dietary counseling, et cetera, and that it would work perhaps more efficiently than the system we have now. We've also done a lot of work on self-administered home non-stress tests for fetal monitoring. These tests are a way to assure fetal well-being for high-risk patients in the third trimester. And we have done some prospective observational trials saying that not only can women use a Doppler monitor at home, but they can actually apply the technology needed to obtain their own non-stress test, and that those tests are highly interpretable. They can be successfully integrated into the healthcare system, and that patient and provider satisfaction with that is very high. But these sort of novel strategies, people have been reluctant to adopt. And so our job, our passion at the University of Utah is really saying, okay, how do we trial these novel strategies to demonstrate that they're feasible and to sort of troubleshoot the pros and cons so that we can think about rolling these out on a larger basis? We have many opportunities, and one of them is to do randomized controlled trials that are badly needed to address the content and delivery of prenatal care, both in high-risk and low-risk populations. And we really need to give some focus to these approaches, which show great potential for reducing disparities in care. 20% of the population, roughly, in the United States is rural. And being able to provide prenatal care to those places that sometimes don't have physicians, or don't have a regular contingency of physicians, or who don't have access to high-risk care, you can see how that this type of modeling of care, connecting people to physicians who might be far away, might be able to decrease those disparities. Ultimately, healthcare systems are increasingly interested in implementing innovative care strategies that improve the quality of healthcare and also improve patient satisfaction while also reducing cost. Right? This is the value equation. You have high value if you can give high quality care at high patient satisfaction and at low cost. And we're actively seeking strategies that help us to do that. The healthcare system is going to change, and it's going to become more and more about how do you manage a population of patients as efficiently as possible. And these types of strategies might be very much a part of that new game. I think it's pretty clear to me, having done some of this research, that over time, this is going to become less of a one-size-fits-all type of a game and a more personalized approach to prenatal care. And I think it's going to change, that slowly we're going to be, although we're slow adopters, we will slowly adopt some of these changes to care. and that the obstetric dogma that we have lived with for many decades will be replaced with a focus on evidence-based care and cost effectiveness and patient satisfaction. I'll end there. Thanks very much. Do we have a few minutes for questions? Yeah. Yeah, so this was a trial, so it was supported through a grant from the Personalized Prenatal, from the Personalized Healthcare Division at the University of Utah. Ultimately, we have to figure out how to implement this, right? Who would pay for it? Ultimately, if we can show cost effectiveness, the goal would be to have payers pay for it. And you give people, you know, they sign up for the program, they get a little package of instruments, they get some instructions, maybe they get an app that facilitates. I think Dr. Wasden talked about that yesterday. So that they get a little kit to take home. For now, as the University of Utah thinks about rolling this out into our standard offerings for prenatal care, the onus is going to be on the patients to pay for that for now, but I hope that that is not the long-term strategy, because it limits, again, there's disparities in care if you use that model. Not everybody is going to be a candidate. Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't hear you very well. Tell me about the elephant. I can't hear you. Oh, okay, but remember that, so unforeseen bad outcomes, is that your question?
At 2 o'clock.
If I want to use novel remote monitoring for your deposition,
it's a
no.
Joke.
But
you're leaving out the elephant in the room, the lawyer.
Well, remember, though, that this is, remember all the organizations who have said this is what we should be doing.
It's irrelevant if you're in a deposition or a trial.
Well, I would argue that the fear of that, when we have excellent evidence suggesting safety and numerous organizations backing this as the pinnacle, the standard by which we should measure ourselves, should not be what determines how we provide care. I understand where you're coming from, but...
Unfortunately, if you have a bad outcome, regardless of the evidence, and regardless of whether you were responsible or not, the lawyer will take everything that is possible to make it look like it was your fault.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. When the randomized trials suggest otherwise, there's going to be bad outcomes always in obstetrics. And I think we have very firm evidence to stand by saying that this is a safe way to provide care. Your concerns, though, that you've just voiced are exactly why we haven't taken that step.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I got to get the people to...
Quick question.
Yes. This was also a big concern. So the question from I'm sorry, tell me your name again.
Dr. Reifelman
was, did we get a bunch more calls, especially pertaining to concerns about using the fetal Doppler? This was something that came up a lot too. I think we approached this in a clinical trial for these very reasons. We knew that our patients were using these devices a lot more than they divulged. We weren't receiving calls about it up until then. And during the trial, it was few, if ever, discussions about the difficulty using the Doppler device or concerns about it. Now remember, we asked them not to use it until after 16 weeks. We made sure they were medically trained to use it before they used it. And when they were in clinic, we reinforced the concepts of how do you use this appropriately. People did beautifully. Yeah. Sure. So 100 in each arm, it was powered for the outcome of patient satisfaction. We didn't... Right, so I didn't present our numbers on medical complications because it wasn't powered for that, but we didn't see an increase in the things that matter, increased risk of growth restriction, stillbirth, preterm delivery, et cetera. We purposely did not power it for that because we would have had to enroll 10 to 20,000 patients. And the randomized trials that have already been done have demonstrated safety of this type of approach. And those randomized controlled trials enrolled a lot of primiparous patients too, primogravidus. So that data had an even higher risk population than we were seeking to enroll. but you guys have very nicely outlined what some of the challenges that we faced in rolling out and doing something new, right? Everyone goes, now wait a second, what about this and what about that, and I'm reluctant to adopt. And that is a very thoughtful approach that is very worthwhile having. And I think now we say, let's look at the data, let's look at this new randomized controlled trial and decide if we're willing to take a baby step forward or not. Thank you very much.
One more.
Excuse me. Your questions are all very important, and we audio all of this. And so to have it clear, in case you want to hear the lecture later with the questions and answers, I need you all to go to the mics. And we can't pass around the mics, so you need to line up on each side. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely marvelous.